Hey, this is Power Card, aka Project Pat, and you're listening to the Baltimore Beatdown Podcast, the best Ravens podcast on the planet.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I'm going to talk to you again.
They lost.
They sure did, pal.
They lost.
Welcome on back to another Prozac needy edition of the Baltimore Beatdown podcast. It is Tuesday, January 14th, and you are listening to a couple fucking losers. Which doesn't, you know, it hasn't changed from any other episode, but it's especially bad today.
It's emphatic. There's an exclamation point on it today.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to just drown myself in Guinness if you just want to start us off here.
Jake's going to chug a loaf of bread real quick. It was a difficult one. It was disappointing. It is what it was. There was, you know, you have to give credit to the Titans first, and that's something that the flock doesn't seem to want to do. They want to talk about the Ravens, but when you can go into New England and then you can go into the number one seed's house, who's been a very good home team, just not a great home playoff team over the last decade plus, you can play turnover free football. The Titans had one interception in New England. They were able to hold on that and then did not turn the ball over in Baltimore. And the Ravens let the Titans take field position, gave them a fluky pick, a bad pick, a bad fumble, and two fourth down stufferoos, five turnovers essentially. You're not going to win playoff football with a 5-1 turnover ratio.
So it feels to me like a game where everything that went right for them, sometimes miraculously, sometimes as a result of something more tangible, went wrong for them in this game. That was going forward on the fourth downs. That was some of the deep shots through the air. That was some of Lamar's running plays and the fact that he had essentially fixed his fumbling problem from his rookie season into this year. Like, it just wasn't a problem at all this year. And then that reared its ugly head. And yeah, man, just one of those games where, and I get into this. I had a little chat with Gordon McGinnis from Pro Football Focus that's going to run at the end of this episode, or at least after you and I are done talking. And he said that it's a game that feels very much like the Ravens lost it as a result of bad luck, which, like, it feels like a shitty, like, cop out to say. But if you look at the facts, that's kind of just, it's
mainly
really
just
not
those fourth and ones.
Yeah, it's the fourth and ones, big issue. Some of the big plays the Titans, you know, were able to hit, not necessarily the wide open touchdown.
Ass cheek.
Yeah, it was the ass touchdown by, I think, Jonnu Smith.
Yep.
That was, yeah, a very lucky play. And, yeah, just I would say poor tackling was another issue in the game, especially when it came to Derrick Henry. But overall, it just really felt like that everything that went right for the Ravens in the regular season went wrong against them in this game, which makes sense. There's going to be a pendulum swing back at some point. But you just really would have hoped.
Aggression is imminent.
Yeah, you would have hoped that it would have come before the playoffs, and it didn't. And so it kind of is what it is. But, you know, what are you going to do? You can't choose when a team peaks and is going to get lucky. Sometimes things just go against you, and that's the rub of the green. But yeah, you got to credit the Titans as well. I think they came in with the right game plan, the right idea. Take a few shots with Tannehill when necessary, manage the game, run it with Henry when you got the momentum going your way, and do that in the correct way. And then approach things on defense correctly as well. It looks like they had Lamar a little bit off base, and I think that really started with the interception, opening things up for the Titans. So yeah, just all around a sloppy, unfortunate mess of a game that I would like to forget about as soon as possible, but it's probably going to be a little while before I can put this one all the way behind me.
Yeah, it's going to be the dark cloud that hangs over the offseason for sure. It was an unspectacular performance to end a spectacular season, and it was unfortunate, and it really was. I mean, sometimes you just need a couple bounces of the ball. I mean, we saw it 2013, the Mile High Miracle, Raheem Moore just doesn't quite go play that ball, you know, that he was in position, doesn't go play it.
Yeah, sometimes I literally talked about this with Gordon, and he was at that game. This felt like that game, and we were just on the other side of it. Like, the Broncos absolutely should have won that game, and that's really not the case here. Like, the Ravens shouldn't have won this game, but it felt like if things had gone for them the way it had been going for them for 12 weeks or so, then they would have easily. But that's the rub of the green, I guess.
It is indeed. The analytics had been your friend, and I still support both of those calls to go for it. The one was pretty the sneakish, whatever you want to say, a little bit of a disappointing. I mean, offensive line made a mess, and Lamar Jackson could have gone up and over. You would like to see maybe. I mean, maybe we go back to Cleveland week 17
when he fumbled on the goal line.
Fumbles on the goal line that really probably should have been a touchdown for the Browns, 100-yard return of that. But, you know, maybe the up and over. And then as Jackson kind of sneaks, I just posted on my Twitter, as Jackson kind of sneaks to his right, he wants to find that bubble. There's a guy there, but just because there's a guy there doesn't mean you can't, you know, gain a couple feet.
It felt like Lamar was a little tentative in this game and kind of second guessing himself.
Yes.
And it felt like for the past 12 weeks, like I mentioned, that just hadn't been the case for him. He had just been completely clicking and rolling. And I guess that's where you kind of got to get out in front of it a little bit. Is rust a factor here, or is that just a natural regression that's going to happen at some point, no matter what?
Well, when we look at how the game started, the Titans get the ball. Ravens force a punt. There was no big plays there. They had a nice little boot backside, throw it to can't think of their third tight end's name. Up the sideline, they get a first down there. Then the Ravens hold up strong. Marcus Peters blows up the screen. Defense is all fired up, pumping fists, whatever. Gets off the field. Ravens drive right down, have a couple dink and dunks, have a Gus Edwards 20-yard run. And then, boom, I'm not calling that a drop. I don't see anyone catching that. Mark Andrews is a 6'5 dude. Wasn't an accurate throw. It wasn't a horrible throw. It wasn't like, oh, God, what a horrible throw, but wasn't an accurate throw.
It was a little offline, and it took an unlucky bounce.
Exactly, unlucky bounce. And then from there, after that moment, Titans go score a touchdown. Then all of a sudden it's 14-0. That's on the other side of the first failed 4th-and-1, I believe. Then it's 14-0 on a huge play. You go for it at midfield. Then Marlon Humphrey gets his freaking head spun around like the exorcism of Emily Rose.
Sick.
And, Chuck Clark's not there deep. Ryan Tannehill puts one on. It's 14-0. And it's immediate PTSD of the Chargers game where, you know, there's a fluky little turnover. And then, oh, no. And can we run the ball still? And, you know, what's going on with Ingram? Ingram looked like shit.
Yeah, he wasn't himself.
And they were showing him on the sideline when I got to go back and rewatch, and he had the heating pad around his calf, and he just didn't look explosive, and it was really a shame. And, I mean, kudos to him for toughing it out, but kind of seems like maybe he should have suited up and fully seceded to Gus Edwards and Justice Hill a little bit. A couple unlucky things happen, and, I mean, then that strip sack was – pretty bad by Lamar, and it wasn't, you know, the read option problems. It was just a strip sack, and you see him kind of double clutch there and triple clutch. He kind of pumped, and it was really silly because Jarrell Casey had already kind of laid a hand on him and touched him. So you know that a defender's, you know, behind you. You got to shit or get off the pot, you know. So he didn't. Ball comes out. boom, 28-6. Then all of a sudden we're looking at the other side of 73 dropbacks in a playoff game by the number one rushing team in the history of football. So it was just flu. It was a fluky game. It happened against the Chargers last year. And does this mean that since Lamar Jackson could not win the Tax Slayer Bowl in 2016, that he can't perform in big games?
Yeah. Lock it in, you fucking douchebag, Clay Travis. But seriously, like get the fuck out of – get all the way out of here with that. Like,
as if bowl games don't matter.
No, they don't.
Bowl games aren't big
unless games. It's the college football playoff, like, and people want to bring that up with Deshaun Watson. Like, it's I'm fine with that.
It's a consolation game.
Yeah, no, it is. It's nothing. A lot of players don't even play in them.
Yeah, all of a sudden everybody sits out of those, whatever, Clay Travis.
And now it's like people are trying to make
some more crack or whatever you smoke, you weirdo.
Yeah, now or some lice for your kids' gross-ass heads. And now
what?
Just Google what? Google Clay Travis lice. Just do it.
All right, I will. Keep talking.
And I don't even – yeah, so people are like trying to make like the – Lamar playoff thing like a narrative now, like it was with Andy Dalton. Like, he's made it to the playoff. Like, you know who else is 0-2 in the playoffs? Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold, Josh Allen, and Josh Rosen.
Yeah, none of them have done a damn thing. Carson Wentz doesn't have a playoff win.
Yeah, so like people are trying to like make it into this thing when like last year,
well,
they
it's the storyline, it's the easiest.
No, I get, yeah, and I get that it's going to happen. It's just it feels a little ridiculous, especially with last year being a just miraculous run with an offense that was not built for him at all, that they completely just revamped to have success with him running the ball. And then, you know, this year, if you want to call him out for choking, go for it. But like, don't say, oh, he's got to get the monkey off his back. Like, it's been 2 years. Like, Peyton Manning didn't win a playoff.
He's younger than Joe Burrow.
Yeah, people don't talk about that. But Peyton Manning didn't win a playoff game until, what, like his sixth or seventh year? I saw that going around. So it's like, you know, sometimes it takes time. Maybe we can relax a little bit. He's going to be the MVP. I think maybe some other success is going to come.
Funny story. No MVP has won a Super Bowl dating back to Kurt Warner, who had Lamar's back after this game.
No, he did. And good for him. He hadn't always been there, but he came around. And that, you know, I'm a superstitious little fucker, and that did concern me. I got to be honest, looking back on it now, I was like,
we should have known with Drake.
Well, that Drake was, yeah, I was
that one Instagram post. He just had to sneak it in.
I was all over that, dude. You know,
wrote an article on it.
I'm an ink under my fingernails journalist. I wrote about it, investigated a little bit, and, you know, I presented both sides. We saw Cassie Calvert saying that the Raptors winning, you know, meant that it's no longer a thing, but it would appear
Raptors
Cass,
are
that it is still.
Home team. That's different.
Yeah, it's just...
He didn't bandwagon on them, Cassie.
It's going to be bad when he, like, comes out with a summer banger, like, Song in the Summer, and it's going to have Big Truss in it, and we're just not going to be able to move on from this.
Big Truss is so dead.
Yeah, really.
It reached, like, oh my gosh, there was just a Facebook post that was out there, and it was a guy that I know that posted, like, a picture of him doing the three-finger truss into the sunset, and it was the back of him, and he put it out into the sunset and posted this thing and saying there was the sentence that said, I, and he put quotes in all caps, trust Lamar Jackson moving forward. And I was just like,
well, you got to give it credit. I mean, the thing had legs when it's getting dudes that like have themselves holding up fish for their Facebook profile pictures, like doing the three fingers thing. You know, that's a wide reaching scenario.
Yes, and there was a little animosity there where the Ravens kind of adopted the phrase into their own gear and hung the Big Trust shirts around the locker room, and then the players didn't take too kindly to it. Because
yeah, like what the fuck was that? Like, calm down, guys.
Yeah, I think that was a little bitchy.
It was.
On the players' behalf.
It was.
A little bad blood there, a little bad blood. But, you know, whatever. It is what it is. Moving on back to this game, it was just unfortunate, disappointing, bad bounces, bad beats. Bears beats Battlestar Galactica, and the Ravens were Dwight Schrute on Saturday, unfortunately.
Yeah, they sure were. I mean, if I had to like come up with an image of them walking off the field, it would probably be Dwight Schrute laying in Christmas wrapping paper with his briefcase next to him after, like, Jim made the fake desk, like, just out of wrapping paper, but he made it look like it was his desk. Yeah. And he was like, you can't take that apart in, you know, however long. And he's like, oh, please, if I can skin a mule deer in less than 60 seconds, I think I can take this apart. And then he just collapses. Sit down in his chair. So,
yeah, the Titans were Jim Halpert on Saturday, and
they were looking at the camera all funky, like, what's going on with this guy?
Yeah, make it. They're just
this is a wild situation. This wouldn't happen in a normal office, or would it? Is that what makes the show relatable? Who knows? Tune in next week on your 4,000th Netflix rewatch so that you can make some more office memes on Twitter, because that hasn't reached an oversaturation point yet. Keep doing it. Keep being original.
That's original content. And you are
I love The Office, but can we calm down with it a little bit? Like, watch another show. There's plenty of other good TV out there. I promise
There's truly so many people that, like, only watch The Office. Like, they go to bed and watch The Office at night and, like, you'll just hear like they're.
I get it like that. I used to do that too, like 5 years ago, but I've moved on. Like, let's get something else going on here. Also, for a fact that a show that just like did not have a good ending at all for like the last three or four seasons of it.
I still have not even watched the last couple seasons. I watched like five episodes because I got into the show like as it was going on, kind of. I can't remember if I watched it from the very beginning, but like couple maybe.
I started in like season three, I think, and I watched from there. Around there. Yeah.
And then I watched a couple of them and I was like watching it on what night was it on Thursday nights or whatever. And
I think
like,
that and Sundays. Yeah.
I was like, I'm not watching this anymore. Okay. I'm done here.
I think that show from seasons 2 through 5 is like peak television. And then it was still probably good through like season 7 with Carell. And then after he left, those last 2 years were just very rough.
They were. And they also, the number one tailspin of The Office is that it caused, and this is something that my professors would say in the electronic media and film department, like, mockumentaries are not allowed. Like, don't write scripts on mockumentaries. We're not making mockumentaries. Apparently there was like all college students wanted to do is just make The Office, but something slightly different. And professors got pretty sick of it. So yeah, no more mockumentaries, Bad Boys.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So the Ravens were Dwight Schrute. Matt Judon played like crap. Brandon Williams played like crap. Brandon Carr looked like a 30-something playing out of position.
So the hot takes were flown about Judon right away. So, like, what's the deal with the contract for you? It doesn't affect me at all.
The outlier is not the norm.
I still want to pay him.
Yeah, the exception is not the rule. And he played really well all year. Let's remove Matt Judon from this team. Let's see how far the Ravens go. He was the only guy who got 30 pressures. If you want to pay someone else, okay, I'm not going to argue. I don't feel like fighting about that. But if you want to pay a different edge, but they need somebody, you can't just not. It depends. I'm not shocked at a franchise tag. He just really had a very poor tackling attempt on Derrick Henry, and that happens to a lot of people. So was what it was. They don't throw the ball, so the pass rusher, Matt Judon, wasn't able to thrive. I think he had one quarterback pressure. The Ravens actually pressured Tannehill, according to PFF, on 9 of his 16 dropbacks.
9 times. I watched that last night.
That's fantastic.
Still holds up. It's great.
That's a good Sunday.
Yeah, like that's – I think I was in a very bad mood, and I was like, all right, I just need something to cheer me up going into this week, which is going to be very long because we have a – conference going on. So I'm going to wake up at 5 a.m. tomorrow and head down to frickin' Hampton Inn by the airport. Airport Hampton to go to a nice conference room and
listen. You got a bagel. You'll be all right.
I'll be a bagel boy.
Yeah, you'll be a bagel boy. But yeah, it got some pressure when it was due. Tannehill made the throws. The most disappointing part of this game overall is just what could have been if the Ravens had performed, and that would be hosting an AFC championship, Lamar Jackson against Patrick Mahomes. And that's where I think I went on last week and said, you know, that's like what the NFL needs. And now, I mean, Derrick Henry has really swept it up. So the NFL will be just fine. I'm sure millions will tune in to see the Titans and the Chiefs.
Yeah. I think the Chiefs are going to fucking smoke them.
Yeah. There was this whole conspiracy YouTube video going around and they were right on, like, they posted it like 5 hours before the Ravens game, before the 49ers game. And they basically said predicted everything this weekend happened correctly, like predicted the themes of the games. And then they're like, the Chiefs are going to destroy the Titans and look like, you know, a monster team heading into the Super Bowl after they dismantled the Texans. And that game was making me feel so much better watching the Chiefs struggle. And then it made me feel 10 times worse than it would have if the Chiefs just, you know, kind of controlled the game from the get-go, or that went differently. So I was like, oh, the Chiefs suck too. Nice.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you know it's a rough go of things, when you're watching like conspiracy theory videos on YouTube and some dude in like Oakley's in his poorly lit bathroom is like telling you like why the NFL is fixed and like, you know, all this shit.
Vegas called, baby. But yeah, in this game, the Titans just didn't give the Ravens a chance to, like, they didn't let them back in the game. They didn't drop the ball, literally or figuratively. Executed really well, tackled really well. They had speed on the perimeter to kind of string Jackson out. And see, that's what was a little difficult, because he has been strung out to the sideline. That's where you see him do that stop on a dime crap and go get 8 yards. And that's like some of the things that were missing offensively. Moving into the next season, one big thing that I hope this offense can kind of evolve and continue moving forward and being able to do is, there were so many times where there was a receiver with like 8, 9, 10 yards of cushion at the line, just no one in front of him. Happened to Justice Hill like 20 times. You got to be able to just turn and throw him the freaking ball like 2 yards past the line of scrimmage, like basically a quick screen, like a pop screen, and just throw it to him. And it felt like, you know, there was a lot of really easy stuff underneath, and Jackson didn't look people off. He wasn't going through his reads. He wasn't, you know, holding the safety and doing all that stuff that made him so great. Maybe it's because the offensive line was getting their butt kicked a little bit and he got hit a couple times, whatever. But, you know, the recipe that everyone wanted to see the Ravens defeat, they could not. They went down early. They did not run the ball effectively. They turned the ball over, and that's what everybody wanted to see, if they could survive that, and they could not. It looked like the only, you know, true threat of a wide receiver that they had in that situation is Hollywood Brown. And at this point, I mean, Patrick Mahomes is the best quarterback in the NFL, but he's got Tyreek Hill, he's got Sammy Watkins, he's got Travis Kelce, he's got Mecole Hardman. DeMarcus Robinson's had a really shit game yesterday, but he's not that bad. So yeah, it's a position that needs to be upgraded moving forward. And Gordon McGinnis, and you were talking about AJ Green possibly and some other guys. So wide receiver is probably the most fun position to go look into the draft and look at free agency. And it's a really exciting position. So a little silver lining will be that we'll be getting into some receiving options this offseason.
Yeah, and they're going to have some cap space to work with, some good draft assets as well because of all the trading back that they've been doing. So they have a good sort of set up to go and, you know, work the offseason a little bit. What would your, I guess we don't have to go too deep into this, we're going to have plenty of time to talk about it, but
right,
from a basic standpoint, what is your approach going to be heading into this offseason if you are Eric DaCosta?
My approach would be, you know, first question is Marshall Yanda staying or going. If he leaves, that makes the interior of my line pretty questionable, because Macari, Skura, Bozeman, those guys definitely benefited from having Yanda next to them, as well as Orlando Brown. I'm sure if you ask Orlando Brown in a private conversation away from the cameras, you know, has that helped you having Marshall Yanda next to you the first 2 years of your career? He's going to give you a, you think, but that's a big question. If he comes back, that's great. If not, that makes a little uncertainty there. Not shocked to see, you know, I haven't gotten into the offensive line tape really at all yet. I'm going to have to in this next week. I'll definitely get ahead of it, but I haven't gotten into that, or maybe bringing a veteran in. There hasn't been a ton of veterans in free agency. Then the next question is Judon. Offseason, basically, you know, you're happy. You had as good of a season as you could want heading into this offseason. Looking back with, you know, is Lamar Jackson going to work out? Is this offense going to work out? How are we going to fare? How are the Browns going to be? How are the Steelers going to be? What are they going to look like? You know, the Ravens look stable. They look successful. They look like they can beat up on really bad teams. And say what you want about Lamar Jackson beating up on bad teams, this, that, or the other, but if he can just consistently dominate not great opponents, you're going to end up making the playoffs a lot. And if you make the playoffs, you can make a run. So all good things. The Ravens have 41 players under contract currently, and that's with no Judon, no Jimmy Smith, no Owosso, no Pierce, lot of those guys gone. And let's say they bring back, you know, three of those guys, Gus Edwards as well, I believe. Bring back three of those guys. You got 44. You got 9 draft picks. That's, you know, not keeping any undrafted free agents. It's not signing anyone outside in free agency if they just retain a couple of those guys. So this isn't a year where I would hate trading up in the draft to get another blue chip talent, young player, maybe a Derek Brown, something like that, a very disruptive force defensively on the defensive line that could maybe replace a Michael Pierce. The Ravens aren't really in that base defense a ton anymore, so maybe they can live without Pierce if you go get somebody else that can maybe rush the passer a little bit and be like a Fletcher Cox kind of role. But all good things. The position's in need early on. It's way too early. We don't know what they've done in free agency, any of that stuff. But it's receiver, it's linebacker, it's outside linebacker, and potentially offensive lineman. So we'll see what they do.
Yeah, I mean, I would say all of that, maintaining the depth is going to be important because this was a very deep team. And sitting down, I think, with the coordinators, each of them, and having a long talk about what they want to do moving forward. I touched on this a little bit with Gordon about how, like, it feels like they can't just run back the same thing. They've got to kind of try and stay ahead of the eight ball. So I'd say sit down with the coordinators, ask them what they want to do, what they want to accomplish, and how they want to execute it, and have DaCosta go and execute it for them. Because I think that open communication and trying to stay ahead of the curve for the coaching staff is going to be key for the team in 2020. Excuse me.
Absolutely. They got to keep evolving. You know, where are the screens? Where's the route combinations? Where's, you know, we watched the Packers game last night. They're running a fake switch route and having Davante Adams run a sluggo. That's not something the Ravens are doing. The route combinations are very basic, very simple. And I hope that's not because of your quarterback, because you can't be limiting him just on that stuff. I mean, it's nothing crazy, but a big hopeful evolution of this offense moving forward is pre-snap, maybe giving Lamar a little bit more responsibility slowly but surely, as he will be 2 years under his belt heading into his third year, allowing him to make a couple decisions at the line there, being able to check in and out of some stuff a little bit more. If he can't do that, he's probably not ever going to win a Super Bowl, because you got to be able to adjust on the fly, and those are the best quarterbacks who can. Got to be able to make some calls. So putting a little bit more on his plate slowly but surely is something moving forward. And defense might have some questions, but after DaCosta, essentially, I don't even know what word to use to explain the turnover that was on defense in the offseason of last year and then this year. There's a couple guys up there, but nothing like losing Weddle, Mosley, Suggs, Urban, Smith, nothing like that. You got most of your guys back. You got Humphrey, you got Thomas, you got Peters, you got Brandon Williams up there. Really just Judon is the one real true big question there, and we'll see how that pans out. So a lot less uncertainty headed into this offseason and a little bit more wiggle room for DaCosta. So hopefully he rocks it again.
We're hoping for the DaCosta sans.
Yeah, I like it.
That do anything for you?
Yeah, all I right, saw good. You were kind of unsure. You wanted my reaction. I give it like a 7.8. I like that.
That's good. That's damn dog. That's a C+.
No, that a 7.8 doesn't mean a C+.
Okay.
I don't give out A's. I don't give out A's.
Okay.
If you get a 9.1, that's like heavy. That's like well better than an A-.
So you're talking about just like rating things on like a.
I've got my own scale.
A decimal point scale, and you know, put it. You know, I like that. No one's doing that.
Yeah, we gotta be hard out here in these streets with our ratings. But yeah, so DaCosta freaking killed it this year, I'd say. You know,
that's probably
something I'm gonna go back and write about the amazing job he did in year one and how Ravens fans don't have to worry about having a stable GM. So that's a blessing for sure.
Yeah, for everyone that was dumping on analytics and my fascination with it. You know, I'm going to take a little bit of a victory lap on you. I was right there. So.
Boom.
Hate to see it.
Love to watch it go.
Oh, man. You sure don't, though, man. Like,
yeah, this sucks. It hasn't hit me yet that there's no more Ravens football, that there's not going to be any more tape to look at. There's not going to be any more games. I'm going to have to go rewatch all the stupid games they've already played that I've already rewatched 5 times. But it is what it is, and it's draft season, and I love draft season. So.
It's okay. Yeah, I think this was therapeutic. We've got a great interview coming up, and great things coming forward with this podcast. So hope you all stay tuned, even if you had your hearts completely ripped out this past weekend, because we're still going to be pumping out the content, and draft season is very much on the way.
Yeah, we're going to try and get some fun interviews, I get some good stuff rocking. I got credentialed up to go to the Senior Bowl. I'm still TBD if I'm going to be able to actually go or not.
The thing about the Senior Bowl is that it's a bowl of seniors.
Yeah, you pour some milk in there and get a bunch of soggy old dudes.
Love to see that happen.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just go to the bowling alley and bowl with the other seniors, but we'll see. And we're excited. This is the end of the Ravens season, but it is just the start of this podcast, as this was our inaugural run, as Jake kind of took it over on the fly, and then I got added to it late. Now we've got everything down pat, and we're excited for what the future holds, and we appreciate all you guys, all the responses, all the mailbags. We'll be probably getting a mailbag a little bit later, maybe this week or something, and we're going to keep pumping out content. We're going to be doing some historical pieces. Jake's baby, he's working on kind of the history of the Baltimore Colts and some Baltimore football, give you some evergreen content you can pump out on a long road trip or a drive to the beach, something like that, if you're bored of other stuff and want to hear some Baltimore football one way or the other. And we'll be getting our guy Connor Rogers back on, I'm sure, and reaching out to some other pundits of the NFL draft and talking all things Ravens all the time.
It's going to be fun. Strap in. It was a great season one. Thanks to everyone for listening, like he said. Thanks for engaging on social media. And yeah, let's just keep it rolling, man. It's been a ton of fun. So without further ado, I guess we can close out that segment of things and throw it over to our interview with Mr. Gordon McGinnis of Pro Football Focus. Gordon is a Scotland-based PFF analyst. He's a Ravens fan. So we sat down and chatted about the team, how he got into doing the whole PFF thing, how he came to football as a guy who grew up in Scotland and still lives there. So it's an interesting, you know, half hour that he gave to us. So it's a fun interview. Hope you guys enjoy it. We will, you know, obviously not be talking to you on the other side of it. So to lead the show out, you can follow the show on social media. You can do so on Twitter at Podcast Beatdown. You can find me at Jake Luke. That's LOUQUE. And you can find Spencer at Ravens 4 Dummies. That's the number 4. Please subscribe to the show, follow it wherever you're getting it, and leave a nice 5-star rating and a review for us if you can. We appreciate you guys and talk to you again on Friday.
Over and out. See you till then.
Goodbye, darkness, my old friend. All right. We now welcome on a very special guest. It is Pro Football Focus senior analyst and social media manager. It's Gordon McGinnis. How you doing tonight, man?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Good. Did I miss anything there with the titles? I feel like you do a lot over there.
No, that's it all for now. I was previously in charge of special teams as well, but I've been able to pass that on to just focus on social media and some other stuff. So,
well, you love to see the special teams guys get opportunities, you know, you don't really see that.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I guess, like, speaking on that, like, before we jump into the actual football stuff, we always like to get a little background with the guests. So explain to maybe like the uninitiated listeners what exactly Pro Football Focus is, kind of in your own words.
So we are a kind of data and analytics service for football teams, for media. So we have all 32 teams in the NFL, and I think we're somewhere between 60 and 70 teams in college, along with some of the major media broadcasters who subscribe to our data. And to be honest, the teams use it in like a wide variety of different ways. Some of them use the grades, some of them use it for video integration, all those things. So depending on, you know, different NFL teams, they all use it in different ways. But we effectively watch every single game, both in the NFL and college. We chart what's happening on the play, but we also grade every player on every play. And that then gives like an overall grade for players, you know, be it for a game, over a season, things like that. And then, you know, we're then able to do content with that. We're then able to, you're kind of grading all players across the same grading scale. So, you know, every left guard in the NFL is graded with the same expectations and things like that. So it's quite a good comparison tool for, you know, who the best players in the NFL are and things like that.
Yeah, fair enough. And it should be pretty obvious at this point that you're not from America. So, you know, you maybe don't cut the typical figure of the analyst that we're used to seeing cover the sport over here. Like, were you always an American football fan, and kind of how is it that you got into doing all this?
So I got into American football, I was probably around about 14. So the first game I ever saw was the Ravens-Raiders AFC Championship game back in early 2001, I think it must have been. Mm-hmm. and just straight away was hooked on it as a sport. Thought it was just I loved the kind of theatrics around it, along with, you know, the kind of hard hitting, but then very quickly understanding that there was a lot of tactical aspects that went along with it. So I was hooked straight away. You know, I watched the Super Bowl a week or 2 weeks later, got into it the following season, and maybe took me another year or so to get like really heavily into it. But joined a fans forum or a message board in the UK. And there were quite a lot of like really hard hitting fans on there that would spend a lot of time discussing things at a very granular level. And one of the guys that happened to be on that forum was Neil Hornsby, who founded Pro Football Focus. So the company actually initially started in the UK. It was, you know, primarily guys in the UK first, and then I kind of helped out a little bit. And then as the company expanded, came on board full time. After I'd been full time for a year, I think that's when Chris Collinsworth became the majority owner. And we then set up our main office in Cincinnati, and the company kind of grew exponentially from there. But initially it was a small operation in the UK with just a bunch of guys who, you know, really love football and, you know, spent a lot of time watching it.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, you can tell just looking at some of the guys that you have there now, like Monson, I think Moo is in Germany, right? So you've got guys from, you know, a lot of different cultural, international backgrounds. I think it's, you know, pretty cool. And what's maybe a little bit weird for the you guys, I would imagine, is that like it's a sport that's just so immediate and it's just very intense, not only over like the 4 months of the season, but pretty much all year. Like, do you find it difficult to sometimes stay up on things when you're covering it due to the time difference between the US and Scotland where you are?
Yeah, I think I've always, because I got really into it when I was like a teenager, I just kind of accepted the fact that I would stay up late. And actually before I was a football fan, like when I was really young, I was a big professional wrestling fan. So I had the same thing that, you know, I would stay up late and watch professional wrestling. And then when it got to like 14, 15, that just changed and I just stayed up late watching football. So it's kind of just for the last 20 odd years just been in my DNA that I just stay up late and watch football. So that makes it a lot easier to stay on top of things.
Yeah, that's, you know, an interesting point there. And it's, you know, maybe a little bit luxurious considering the fact that I'm sitting at work trying to stream Champions League games sometimes. So that could be a little bit difficult. But, you know, in a similar vein, you're very much in that analysis world and you're kind of always looking at things with a critical eye. Like, I'm curious, as someone who works for PFF, and you mentioned how long you've been doing it, you guys literally have your own systems of evaluation. Like, are you ever able, I'm sure you are, but like, are you ever able to like really take that analyst hat off and just kind of enjoy watching the game as a fan? Or are you kind of always watching them unfold with the trained eyes that you have?
I think it definitely has changed over the years for me. I think initially I came from that aspect of being a fan, and then through the first few years I was at PFF, was so focused on grading everything and learning the grading system that it was very difficult to watch a game and not, you know, focus just on everything like that. As things have gone on a little bit, and especially now that I run social media for us, I've kind of allowed myself to focus on the fun aspects of it as well. And that's kind of brought a bit more of the fan aspect back into it. So yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I would still say I definitely watch it with a little bit more of an analyst hat than I did when I first started watching the sport, but probably a little bit less than I did a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I'm like a film fan, and you hear directors like talk about how they can't watch a movie without looking at it from like a technical perspective. So I think somebody so deep in that analysis game, I think, you know, the same thing could apply for sports. But I'm also curious about like the nuances of working for a company that is very numbers based. You know, especially even a couple of years ago, and maybe, you know, to an extent still this day, you kind of feel like people are maybe a little resistant to something like PFF that's a little more new age and, you know, numbers heavy, as I mentioned. What do you kind of say to the people who are a little bit critical of your guys' metrics at times?
So one of the things we've always been quite open with, you know, players, especially the offensive line, because that's a position that hasn't really had a microscope shone on it before. A lot of those guys have been critical, or even not necessarily critical, but kind of questioning about things. And we've always had an open door policy with players. You know, we've had players that have come into the office and, you know, sat and watched film with us. We've had players who've, you know, got onto Skype and had a conversation with their analysts about plays, allowing them to query things that, you know, that kind of come up there. So the fact that we've always had that kind of transparency with players. Anytime they've got a question, we're happy to answer it. I think that's always helped. And we kind of saw that with the coaching thing this year. So we got a fair bit of publicity on the Mike McCarthy hire when he'd came into our offices last summer. He'd spent a lot of time in the off season just trying to learn about things in football that he maybe had, you know, maybe was missing as things had developed. Came into our offices, spent some time with the guys, you know, learned about what we did, asked a whole bunch of questions about ways that he could apply it to things. So we've definitely seen in the last, probably the last 3 years, there has been a significant attitude change. But you're always going to have resistance from, you know, some people who view things very old school wise, some people who are just skeptical of, you know, these guys from the UK that started up a company that grades players in the NFL. But I think the fact that we've always been willing to sit down with people and show them these things has helped us out.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it's getting more mainstream these days, especially with like the Collinsworth, you know, acquisition. You've got the PFF grades popping up on Sunday Night Football, which wasn't really something you saw 4 years ago, maybe. Maybe I'm just, you know, totally guessing on that. But is that kind of a conversation that you find yourself still having a lot? Or do you guys think you've been around sort of long enough here where you're becoming an established name and it's not really much of a question anymore?
Yeah, I mean, we do still get it. You'll get, you know, managing social media, you get a lot of people who'll happily tweet us and tell us that they don't care about the grades and, you know, no one takes our grades seriously and all this stuff. So I think there always will be that resistance because sometimes there's just like a lack of understanding on things and, you know, that is always going to leave these things. But yeah, it's definitely improved a little bit. And yeah, I think you're right. I think it's been about 4 years that the grades have been on Sunday Night Football. And yeah, I think that probably sums it up.
Yeah, definitely. So just kind of like last thing on that, if you could set one misconception straight about the way people view what you guys are doing, what would it be?
So I think there's always the misconception of not knowing what the play call is. And I think not knowing what the play call is itself isn't necessarily a huge misconception because you're never going to know what the exact play call is. But when you've got, I think we've now got about 14 years worth of data, you know, you've got a whole bunch of plays that you've graded. I think at last check in the last decade, I think it was like six figures worth of plays that we graded over that span. And if you grade players with the same expectations on those plays, you know, we know the difference between inside zone and outside zone on runs. If you grade players along that way, then everything's going to even out in a general level between, you know, there's not going to be a bias that we're missing out on this part of grading. If you grade everything across the same scale, everything's going to even out.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we can pivot away from that a little bit and over to the Ravens because we are a Ravens based podcast. I do have to ask, are you a Ravens fan?
Yeah. So I mean, I've been over to Baltimore three times, I think. Actually, I went to the AFC Championship game in New England that they lost the Billy Cundiff missed field goal. And then the following year, I was in Denver when they won that game. That was actually the last game I went to because those 2 years I was part-time at PFF, and that summer was when I got the full-time offer. And working full-time, I just don't get the opportunity to fly over for games anymore. So.
Right, yeah, because, you know, you kind of caught my eye, you know, tweeting about them fairly consistently, and the fact that you're a relatively big name on Twitter, you kind of tend to pick those people out, especially when you're rooting for a small market team and you've got that chip on your shoulder. It's kind of cool
exactly.
See that happen. But, I mean, you know, just starting off with this season, for me, it was one of the most unexpected 14-win teams I can remember from any year, like let alone from a squad that had so many questions surrounding them, like literally just an offseason ago. What was your perspective on this team heading into the year and kind of what they were capable of, let's say, heading into training camp?
Yeah, I mean, I thought they were going to be around about 500. I thought they were probably going to miss the playoffs because I expected Cleveland and Pittsburgh to be better. And just, you know, I'll happily hold my hand up and admit what we saw from Lamar Jackson as a rookie, I just didn't see where the development as a passer was going to come that was going to, you know, really transform them into a Super Bowl contender. I kind of thought that probably a little bit similar to what they, you know, the success they'd had with Joe Flacco, you know, with Lamar Jackson, maybe they'd just focus on the running game and hopefully he got hot for a few games in December and January. I just didn't see the huge step forward coming, and I also didn't see the big step forward in decision making. And, you know, obviously the analytics background with PFF, John Harbaugh, I think this year just did a great job just putting the team in positions to win. So when you add in those things, I think the Ravens have gone from a team that I didn't expect to be a playoff team this year to a team that really should be a contender for the next, at least throughout Lamar Jackson's rookie contract.
Yeah, you know, I was sort of in the same boat. I think I had him around 9-7. I expected a little bit of a step forward from Lamar, but, you know, nothing to the quite the caliber that he actually did take that step forward. So for me, it was more a function of the fact that I just felt like the offense was so perfectly built around him. Is that kind of a sentiment that you, you know, would have thought back at the time, or were you a little more skeptical?
Yeah, I thought they were going to build the offense around him. And I think they did a really good job. You know, tailoring the offense to his skill set, you know, and creating open passes for him to complete. But just the level of different athlete he is, and the level he improved as a passer, that was the thing that I just didn't see that step coming.
Yeah, that makes sense. And they get off to a rocky start at 2-2. And his play was looking a little bit up and down on balance. I know he had like a good statistical start, but the games against, who was it? Well, obviously the Cleveland loss was pretty bad, and then the Chiefs loss, there was some up and down stuff. So was there anything from your perspective that sort of encouraged you that he was going to turn things around at that point, a quarter of the way into the season? Or were you still a little, you know, kind of thinking back to his rookie year and some of the mistakes that he had been making?
Yeah, I can remember probably around about week three, week four, I was kind of the opinion that he was probably going to be a quarterback who one week could have a really good game, the following week could have a really poor game. And, you know, especially as a passer, was probably going to have a little bit of a roller coaster, that things were going to be quite up and down. But really, I think kind of from just after the Pittsburgh game onwards, that's when his consistency really started to kind of, you know, really get there. And I think that was a big part in this season kicking on.
Yeah, definitely. That was a big part of it. And they turn it around thanks to that, and also the defensive renaissance that they had there in the, you know, middle of the season, essentially. That was huge as well. What was your reaction to the Marcus Peters trade when it went down, and how would you say he's kind of performed against that initial judgment that you made?
Yeah, I think that was a huge trade for them, especially they really didn't give up a lot. You know, they gave up a fifth rounder and a backup linebacker in Kenny Young. The interesting thing with the Ravens and how they've taken a very kind of analytics based approach is that the way they've built that defense is very much what analytics says that you should, you know, you build it from the back, you build it with your coverage unit. And if you have a strong coverage unit, you can actually mask a lot of the deficiencies with your pass rush. And I think that's something the Ravens did. And, you know, when they got to mid-season and they had Marcus Peters in there, they had Jimmy Smith coming back from injury, they had such a strong group of cornerbacks that it's tough to complete passes against a unit that has three, four strong cornerbacks across the board. And then, you know, a guy like Earl Thomas, who they could shuffle around and move around and do some things there. But the fact that they've been able to lock up Marcus Peters for the next couple of years, the fact that Marlon Humphrey's there, Tavon Young coming back off injury next year, they're a team that are very much set up the right way defensively. And I think having that strength in the defensive backfield, that's what allows Wink Martindale to be so creative up front. And I think you saw that with their pass rush.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting that you bring up the whole analytics thing with DaCosta. To what degree do you think he is actually a very analytically oriented general manager, or is some of that maybe a little bit exaggerated? What do you think?
So I think it's probably fairly early days. But I think when you look at the Ravens in general, when you look at the stories we saw around the hires they made, I think they made two or three hires in their analytics department. They've obviously got the guy who talks to John Harbaugh around decision making. When you piece those things together with the signings they made, and, you know, they didn't go after a pass rusher at the trade deadline or in free agency, but what they did do was trade for Marcus Peters. What they did do was sign Earl Thomas. Everything they did very much points towards a front office and a coaching staff that have bought in fairly fully to analytics.
Yeah, I mean, and they were fairly fleet on their feet with transactions throughout the regular season. Peters obviously kind of being the biggest one, but what would you say was the other biggest defensive addition that DaCosta made throughout the regular season? Because you can definitely point to a few other than Peters, I would say.
Yeah, I think the big moves were after Peters were the linebackers, especially that Cleveland game early on. They looked to be really struggling at linebacker. And I remember when the trade, when the signings happened and they picked up LJ Fort and Josh Bynes, and everyone was just kind of like, these signings aren't a big deal, but they felt like sneaky good signings because neither one of those players is ever going to be a Ray Lewis, a Luke Kuechly. But if you look at what they've done over the course of their careers, if you look at how they've graded for us, they're almost always very solid players. And one of the things I've always found quite fascinating is the Bill Belichick theory that he would rather have a bunch of 6 or 7 out of 10s on his defense than a guy who's an 8-1 play and a 2 the next and then a 7 and then a 5. And I think especially at linebacker in the middle of that defense, if you have guys who you know are going to give you a solid performance 95% of the time, that alone has a fair bit of value.
Yeah, definitely. And you make all those additions on D, the offense gets rolling. And the, you know, end result is a huge run where they don't lose another regular season game. Like, do you see that more as like a testament to that talent that they brought in to save the day or to the coaching staff for kind of adapting things on the fly and sort of being malleable?
Yeah, I think it's probably a combination of both. I think the fact that they were so willing to make those changes, you know, they weren't arrogant about coming into the season with a team that they thought were going to be good. As soon as they saw some areas to improve and as soon as they saw some opportunities to improve, they did that. And I think that's a testament to not just a coaching staff and front office, but just an organization that understands what it takes to win. And that's probably a big reason why the Ravens have in general been so successful throughout their time in the NFL.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, speaking of successful, obviously that was, you know, a big, you know, aspect for the offense this season is that it was successful for maybe the first time in franchise history for real. And there were a lot of promising players to look at on the offense. Is there anything from maybe your analysis or some more specific advanced stats that you can look at that get you excited about any of the players on that side of the ball, maybe other than Lamar moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to not get really excited about the offense. You know, when you saw what Ronnie Stanley did at left tackle this year, made himself an absolute ton of money. You know, the Ravens offensive scheme obviously makes edge defenders have to focus on Lamar Jackson, and that can make things a little bit easier for both the left and right tackles for the Ravens. But Stanley's numbers throughout the year, I think he finished the year having allowed like 6 total pressures throughout the year, which is the best we've ever seen from an offensive tackle at PFF in, you know, that's 14 odd years worth of grading. We haven't seen a left tackle play this well for the Ravens since Jonathan Ogden was there. The Mark Andrews thing in the tight ends, I think, is quite interesting because Andrews had a great season this year and there was a bunch of explosive plays, but there were also some drops in there. So I do wonder a little bit if next season his numbers might come down a little bit just because of that. But I think the player to get really excited about is Marquise Brown. I think, you know, he was injured throughout the whole year, but still had some significant flashes as the season went on. And in that playoff game, that game really might not have even been a contest early in the second half if it hadn't been for his big plays in the first half, especially that one down the right sideline right before halftime.
Yeah, definitely. He flashed big time in that Titans game. Going back to the tight ends real quick, I mean, it seems like Andrews is the sort of locked in starter there, especially with the fact that he is the pass catcher, and that's sort of what you need to be these days. Going into the offseason, you know, you're going to want to try to make a lot of moves to capitalize on this Lamar rookie deal. Looking at that tight end spot, like, do you consider trading one of the other two guys, you know, Hurst or Boyle? And do you think that could maybe get you any sort of significant return that would make it a plausible move to happen?
I think if the Ravens look at it, they probably wouldn't get the value they would like in terms of what they contribute to the team. I think Nick Boyle obviously got a fairly big contract last year, and that was with Mark Andrews and Hayden Hurst already on the roster. So I think the way the Ravens are set up offensively, they probably are expecting to go into next year using three tight ends fairly significantly throughout the year. And I think the other thing with Hayden Hurst is, you know, he got kind of overshadowed by Mark Andrews. But over the second half of the year, actually had a decent number of plays that he made in the passing game. Again, in the playoff game at the weekend there, had the pass that just hit him clean in the chest, in the fourth quarter. But other than that, I think he had like 3 first downs in the game before then. So, I think they're going to look to get all 3 of those guys involved. Nick Boyle's the guy who is the best blocker of the group, and I think he's going to have a role there. But it wouldn't shock me to see a little bit more balance between Hayden Hurst and Mark Andrews next year. I think Andrews will still lead the group, but it wouldn't shock me if Hurst's numbers go up a little bit to get a little bit closer to him.
Yeah, I agree that I think they're going to be retaining all of them. I do think it's an interesting sort of scenario where if they do get a good bang for their buck, potentially on a move that you could maybe see one happen. But, you know, moving away from that and over to the coaching staff, you know, there was expected to be turnover there and there wasn't. And I think it's huge that both of those coordinators were retained. I'm sure you'd agree. How much of like a change do you think we'll see from them on both sides of the ball to try and stay ahead of the curve in 2020? Because you got to think they're not just going to try and do the same exact thing they did this year, right?
Yeah, I think what you've seen from what you saw from Greg Roman this year was a system that was very tough for teams to beat. But the more film people have on that, the more things they're going to be able to try and exploit on that. So he's going to have to develop the offense a little bit. And I think you'll probably see them look to try and get the wide receivers involved a little bit more. And, a large part of the offense this year might have been because they were very inexperienced at wide receiver. Marquise Brown and Boykin there. And then, the veterans were like guys like Willie Snead. Outside of that, there wasn't really a strong veteran presence at wide receiver. So if they can go out and improve at that position, and Marquise Brown and Miles Boykin have like an extra year under their belts, all of a sudden that position can become a lot stronger, and the offense might suddenly move away a little bit from the middle of the field and start attacking the outside a little bit more. And on the defensive side of the ball, I don't know that there's going to be too much in the way of change. I think Wink Martindale's style works really well in the sense that I suppose the change is that I think he's always changing things up to make things confusing for people. He's willing to have Earl Thomas as a center fielder or safety, and then he's happy to bring him up and blitz him off the edge. Steve and Sam, who do our PFF NFL show, when they were talking about the Ravens earlier in the year, they were talking about the fact that the Ravens at one point just had an outside cornerback blitz and got a sack off of it. Like, Wink Martindale is willing to try things that most coaches are too scared to try, and I think being so strong in the defensive backfield is going to allow him to just continue to be aggressive up front and move some things around and just get the most out of players in their front seven.
I wanted to go back to the wide receiver position real quick. What do you see as maybe a potential ideal fit in this offense, considering the players that they have, considering the offense that Roman wants to run? Is it going to be another one of the smaller shifty guys, or do you maybe bring like a power forward type in? I'm kind of curious what you think a good fit would be for next year.
Really interesting thing I saw. We had an article today. We've done an article every week since the playoffs began of teams that didn't make the playoffs and then teams that have gone out, how they can make a Super Bowl run in 2020. The name that Eric Eager, who wrote the article, floated out there for the Ravens was AJ Green. And that I think would fill that kind of power forward type role. If you have Marquise Brown as a speedster who can make plays downfield, AJ Green can still make plays downfield, but is a nice big target that for Lamar Jackson, especially the style of pass he likes to throw, could go up and win a lot of passes there. Through the draft, I think potentially they're going to look to try and find speed again, because they very much emphasized speed last offseason. I don't think that'll change, but AJ Green would be a fairly significant free agent splash, and I don't think it's necessarily a strange fit, despite the fact that he's played in Cincinnati, because he's a guy who's late on in his career has never really had the chance to go and win a Super Bowl. And the Ravens are coming off a 14-2 season. If the Bengals don't franchise tag him, and I think it would be fairly strange if they did, I think there's a good chance that the Ravens could be fairly successful if they made a run at him.
Yeah, I mean, anything to get him the fuck out of Cincinnati so he can stop torturing Ravens fans. But, speaking of torturing Ravens fans, I guess we got to touch on the playoff loss a little bit here. How would you sum up why they lost in such a convincing fashion in, let's say one sentence?
Do you know, I've taken a lot of flack on this, mainly from Titans fans over the last couple of days. I think bad luck is the way to look at it. You know, you look at what that game turned on, and I talked about this with guys at PFF, and we talked about how the Ravens lose in the playoffs, and the way we saw them losing in the playoffs was being outscored by Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs, or going up against a Texans team that just really clicks on offense, and the Texans keep scoring on offense and they get outscored there. Against a Tennessee, against a Buffalo, against even a New England, the only real way the Ravens were likely to lose was if they had some bad luck with, say, Lamar Jackson fumbling, if they had some interceptions or turnovers in their own half of the field, or some big returns. And one of the things we'd seen the Ravens dominate throughout the year was fourth down conversions. And they were above, you know, the level that they were hitting on fourth downs was unrealistic to continue at. So at some point you were always expecting a little bit of regression. And I think in that game, the tipped interception early on that led to a big return, and then the penalty, followed by the two fourth down, fourth and one failures, those three plays alone completely changed that game. And I think people look at that game and everyone talks about Derrick Henry being unstoppable. I saw Mina Kimes tweet this, I think, yesterday or maybe even Saturday night. The Tennessee Titans had two drives that went for 35 or over 35 yards. There was the Ryan Tannehill pass after the fourth and one failure, and there was the drive that had the 66-yard Derrick Henry run. I think if you play that game again 10 times, the Ravens win it 7 or 8 times, just because it was just one of those games that sometimes bad things happen and they just go against you. And it's really tough for a team that were 14-2 Super Bowl front runners for the first time in team history. It's really tough to look at that and, you know, the deflating fact of it going so badly wrong. But I think if you look at that and what you'd want the Ravens to do differently next year, you just want them to not make those mistakes that happened or have that bad luck. If they don't have that bad luck, they're probably playing in the AFC Championship game.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the vibe I get from it, is bad luck. You got balls bouncing off of guys' hands, you know, the Titans, you know, making some really incredible plays. The guy, I think it was Jonnu Smith with the corner of the end zone catch. That doesn't happen in a normal game. So it's, and it reminds me a lot, actually, of that Denver game that you were in attendance for, 6 years ago, where everything kind of broke against the Broncos in a game that they really could have and should have won, and it broke for the Ravens, so they were able to win it. But as far as like the front office and that game, what do you expect them to take from that game, and how aggressive do you think that they'll be in trying to fix what went wrong, if that's the way that they indeed do see it?
Yeah, I really hope they don't. The one fear I would have coming out of that game is that, you know, we only had this one season of the Ravens being aggressive with fourth down and, you know, things like that. And also it's not even just the fourth downs, but they also were passing the ball on early downs and things like that, that just open up an offense significantly. My worry would be that they turn around and, you know, retreat a little bit back into their shells and try and be a little bit more conservative, which I just don't think fits who they are as a team. But I think they're a smart team to and to understand that they don't need to make sweeping changes from that playoff loss. And I think what they'll probably do is they'll just try and use the cap room they have. It's not, you know, a huge amount, but it's enough to go out and improve that team. Maybe make a splash at wide receiver if it's an AJ Green or someone else. You know, look to shore up some things on the defensive side of the ball as well. The one area I think they could probably look to improve upon is their strength against the run in the front seven. We saw a couple of times, you know, the times they lost this year were times where they got into a position where teams weren't chasing them and they had to chase teams. And they were a little bit soft up front in the front seven, probably at linebacker more than anything else, whereby if a team had a 2-touchdown lead on you, they can run the ball and they can take some time off the clock and they can do the things that, you know, the Ravens were able to do once they had a 14-0 lead. So I think they'll probably look to try and shore up the front seven a little bit, just to try and stop that, because if there was one thing that the Titans did well, it was once they had that lead early on, they were able to kind of suffocate the Ravens and take the air out of the ball and take a lot of time off the clock.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously it's a tough spot to be in. We're recording this the Monday after it happened on Saturday night, so it's a very sore subject. But if there's anything positive that you think fans could maybe take from that one, despite how heartbreaking it all is, what would it be?
I think it has to be Lamar. I think in my 14, 15 years watching the Ravens, I don't think I've ever – the only other player I've seen who is so exciting that can turn something into nothing in a split second is probably Ed Reed at safety. What Lamar did this year was ridiculous. Even just from a statistical standpoint, you know, breaking the rushing record, but at the same time leading the NFL in touchdown passes. And when I was tweeting about the game on Sunday, there were people telling me that, well, you know, it's different because he's not a pocket passer, this, that, or next thing. He led the NFL in touchdown passes from the pocket, from straight dropbacks, without scrambling, without rolling out. No one threw more touchdowns than he did last year. So the fact that he took such a huge step forward as a passer, I think is a great sign for the Ravens. And, you know, this year we saw Patrick Mahomes regress a little bit from a ludicrous stat line. So I think there's a fairly decent chance that Lamar Jackson will regress a little bit in terms of those ridiculous numbers. But I think the fact that he broke the record in only 16 games, he's probably going to threaten the rushing record again. And if he's even 75% of the passer that he was this year, they're probably still somewhere, you know, at least 11 wins and still going to contend for a Super Bowl.
Definitely. Well, I had to get that positive spin on it because it's been a rough couple of days around here, and I'm sure it has been up there for you too. But we do appreciate the sentiment, and we really appreciate you coming on, my man. You got anything you want to plug before we let you get out of here?
Just everything we're doing at PFF, obviously. You know, with the Ravens season coming to an end now, we're only a couple of games from the end, and then it'll be full off-season focus with free agency and the draft. You know, we're working on a draft show and things this year, so I think we're going to have a lot of cool stuff that I think is well worth people checking out.
Well, I love it. And you ever get out here, you know, let me know, and we'll go for crabs or something. And if I ever get up there for a golf trip, God willing, we'll go for a pint. How's that sound?
Sounds good. Just let me know.
All right, man. Bye.
Awesome. Thanks.
You see, I ain't no big sack, man. I don't like sacks, man. See, sacks take me out of my game. I like running folks down.
I like interceptions and touchdowns.
Busting up the streams
and blocking punts.
You in the gutter.
I like
you're
that.
You're in the gutter.
I like that bump and grind.
He like the trick work.
That boy like to get down. Like down and dirty.
I like busting up screens. I just like hitting quarterbacks. Yeah.
That's my
plan. That's a nice.
I grab a quarterback. And I bang, bang, bang all day.